second case of the morning, Motorola versus the State of New Jersey, appeal number 09-1750. And we have Mr. Cleveland.
Good morning. May it please the Court. The nearly 77,000 participants in the Motorola 401k plan who bought Motorola stock for their accounts made the same decision to buy stock based on the same information as the members of the class who are sharing in the settlement of this case. The stock the plan participants bought and the losses they suffered were the same. Yet they have been denied the right to share in the settlement and are indeed left remedyless. This result is fundamentally unfair and legally unjustifiable. The standard of review to be applied to the Court's decision affirming the denial of the plan's claim is de novo. The Court construed the stipulation, which is a contract, as a matter of law and applied a plain meaning analysis to two terms in the agreement, publicly traded and affiliate. We submit the Court's analysis was incorrect. That is a decision for the Court to adjudge de novo. The suggestion made by lead plaintiff that there's clearly erroneous standard applies is simply wrong. Suffice it to say that the District Court did not purport to make factual findings and did not make factual findings, nor was the District Court asked to make factual findings. The claim was denied based on the Court's interpretation of the stipulation, which was, again, as I stated, a matter of law. The claim brought here is brought by the plan on behalf of the participants. The plan is a collection of individual accounts held by the participants. Any attempt to distinguish between the two is meaningless. The plan filed on behalf of the participants. The participants are the individuals who will benefit from the plan's claim if the claim is denied. This procedure was expressly approved of by the District Court in the Kurzweil case, where the Court found that it was correct for the plan to have filed a claim on behalf of the participants. Lead plaintiff appears to argue on appeal that the plan somehow or other lacked capacity to bring the claim for the participants. No such argument was advanced by the lead plaintiff below, nor did the District Court adopt any such argument. Furthermore, the argument that lead plaintiff makes is a bit of a red herring. Below, as we've set out in our briefs, prior to the proceedings below, while the plan's claim was being debated, if you will, the lead plaintiff took the position that even if individual participants were to go ahead and submit a claim, their claim would be denied on the basis that the stock that the participants held in their accounts was not publicly traded stock. If that was indeed lead plaintiff's position, lead plaintiff could have and indeed should have responded to the claim by directing the participants file their own claim. Of course, lead plaintiff having taken the position that any such claim would be baseless renders moot the filing of any individual participant claims. The grounds that the District Court denied the claim based upon are simply incorrect. First, the plan is not an affiliate of any defendant in this case. The parties on appeal.
What do you think that word means?
Affiliate means control. The parties on appeal seem to agree that for affiliate status, control needs to be established. And that was the thrust of Judge Pallmeyer's decision, although she applied a somewhat outdated definition of affiliate. And she incorrectly concluded that the plan was an affiliate of Motorola. That the Motorola board appoints the plan committee, which administers the plan, does not mean that the plan is controlled by Motorola. This case and the claim in this case relate to investment decisions made by participants. Motorola, the board, the committee exercised no control there.
Well, they exercised control over what mutual funds and other investment devices were made available to plan participants, right? So, I mean, plan participants couldn't purchase whatever securities they wanted to. They had to purchase from among the small number of select funds, including this one, that were available.
The committee adopts a menu, and it's up to the participants to choose amongst that menu in terms of what investments they desire. But it's solely
so they're exercising control in that sense to decide what investment vehicles to make available to plan participants.
In the sense that the committee, in that sense, exercises control and that it does choose the investment vehicles.
But the committee is appointed by Motorola.
The committee is appointed by the Motorola board. That is correct.
That sounds like control to me.
Well, I would submit to Your Honor that it's not, because the focus here is on investments. And the investment decisions here are made by the participants, not made by the board or anyone else. And our position here is entirely consistent with the position the SEC has taken, this after all being a securities case. I think those decisions are instructive. Those no-action letters are instructive, although Judge Pallmeyer did not refer to them.
Those no-action letter that you rely on, or the no-action letters, I guess there's more than one, have to do with this look-through principle, as I understand it, and don't really have anything to do with whether a plan such as this is an affiliate.
Well, in fact, they are material here, and the look-through principle is material, because if the plan in those no-action letters was an affiliate, for purposes of Rule 144, certain requirements of that rule would have to be fulfilled. The SEC has consistently said, we look through the plan to the participants, because it's actually the participants here who are the investors.
Right,
and that's exactly the case here.
Threshold question about where the focus should be in applying the definition of affiliate, whether the focus should be on the plan or whether the focus should be on the participants. It's not an ultimate conclusion on the part of the SEC about whether a pension plan is an affiliate of its sponsoring corporation. So those no-action letters don't address that proposition or that question.
Well, I respectfully submit that they do, and that this Court's focus needs to be on what the decision is that's an issue here. And the decision an issue here is the decision of an individual John Jones participant to choose to invest in Motorola stock. Nobody controls that decision except Mr. Jones. And that's the real focus here. I would also point out that Judge Pallmeyer's subsequent decision in rendered subsequent to the decision in this case in the ERISA litigation is consistent with the SEC interpretation, because Judge Pallmeyer says it's the participants here who make the investment decisions, just like any other investor in Motorola stock. So that Judge Pallmeyer's later decision, while consistent with the SEC no-action letters, is markedly inconsistent with her decision in this case, which remits the participants to whatever remedy they may have under the ERISA Act.
I don't understand how this plan can't be an affiliate of Motorola, and maybe you can explain that to me. But if the people who control the plan are appointed by Motorola executives, it's the Motorola plan. The claim is filed by the plan and signed by a Motorola executive. And then it's actually filed by the lawyers who represented Motorola. In the face of all that, how in the world can it not be an affiliate?
The plan may, for certain purposes, be an affiliate, but it's not an affiliate for this purpose. If there's nothing wrong with the plan, with the claim being submitted on behalf of participants by the plan. Kurzweil, again, supports that and says it makes sense. So that,
but the claim here was actually filed by the plan, by the participants.
It was submitted by the plan on behalf of the participants. That's correct.
However, in Kurzweil, wasn't it the plan participants who were the claimants?
No, Your Honor. Some plan participants submitted their claims independently, but Kurzweil specifically recognizes, I believe, the appropriateness of the plan submitting the claim. Here, the participant is in exactly the same situation as someone who might buy Motorola stock on the New York Stock Exchange or some other stock exchange. Simply, the mere vehicle or the fact that investment takes place through a unitized trust shouldn't make any difference.
Well, you might be right, but the definition of the class is people who purchased it publicly. And these plan participants didn't purchase it publicly. They bought and sold amongst themselves, and the plan went out in the market to balance it out on a daily basis.
Well, you know, there's really only one kind of stock at issue in this case, and that's publicly traded Motorola stock, bearing the CUSIP number that lead plaintiff repeatedly cites in its response brief.
The plan holds title to that, though, doesn't it?
Pardon me?
The plan holds title to the securities?
The plan holds title to the securities. However, participants vote the securities, are free to direct decisions to buy and sell the securities, and indeed can receive the actual securities in certain circumstances. They are absolutely indistinguishable from any other owner of Motorola securities. So that the decision that stock is not publicly, the ruling that stock is not publicly traded is also, I would submit, incorrect. I desire to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, so I'll conclude at this juncture.
Mr. Herod.
May it please the Court. If the plan's arguments are to be accepted, it would materially alter the judgment that the district court entered and also change the terms of the settlement that the court approved. The first thing that we need to address in this appeal is who actually filed the claim. And as Your Honors have, I think, pointed out, there's a great deal of evidence in support of the fact that it's the plan that is the actor that is at issue here. The plan filed the claim. It signed the claim. And the claim never purported on its face to be filed on behalf of the participants.
That defeats your argument under the publicly traded part of the definition.
Well, Your Honor, I think the question that you need to ask is, if the plan is an affiliate and excluded from the class.
That's a separate issue.
Okay. And I think.
But if the plan is the claimant here, the plan purchased publicly traded shares of Motorola stock.
I do not contest that the plan goes into the market and purchases common stock.
So you're conceding that?
Yes.
Okay.
But the plan cannot participate in the settlement because it is an excluded affiliate.
Got it.
So we only reach the question of who has the ability to make a claim after we've determined who that person is and whether or not that they are a member of the class. In this situation, the plan is the party that filed the claim, and they are not a member of the class.
Well, why were these employees excluded from the class definition in the first place? Or at least, why wasn't it more clear that they were excluded?
Your Honor, I would submit that it was clear. The class, the notice of the certified class was distributed twice, once in connection with a notice of pendency that was disseminated in January of 2006, and a second time after the district court had preliminarily approved the settlement. In both cases, it said the class consists of persons who purchased publicly traded Motorola common stock. In the notice of settlement, it was even more specific. It stated that it had to bear a specific CUSIP number. In addition, in the notice, it says that you had to have directly purchased Motorola common stock.
Yeah, but, I mean, some person who's a participant in this plan who doesn't really understand the ins and outs of all this could reasonably believe that they're a member of this class and they're going to participate in the settlement. I mean, wouldn't it have been better to specifically say that the employees are excluded so that if they want to file their own securities action, they're free to do that? So it's almost like it's a shell game here.
It was not, Your Honor. I mean, the issue had not really been joined. We were not really paying a lot of attention to, you know, we wanted to limit the class for lots of different reasons to securities that we thought had incurred a loss as a result of the defendant's misconduct that we were pursuing in the case. So perhaps in hindsight, had we, you know, thought about this, we maybe would have done that. And the fact is that the way these settlements are approved and before judgment is entered, notice is disseminated to the class. And had someone come forward from the plan to object to the settlement, this appeal or this dispute would be at an entirely different posture.
Did the individual participants get the notice?
Your Honor, this is what I can explain to you about that. Both notices that were disseminated to the class include a very specific provision. And that provision says if you are a nominee or you hold shares on behalf of other people who own the common stock, you are required under the notices, in effect, a court order, you are required to disseminate this notice to those beneficial owners. Okay, so that went out to the way the notice gets disseminated is we get a list of the record holders from the company's transfer agent, then we mail notice to those people. The nominee holders, who are the record holders on behalf of people who own the stock beneficially, are then required to distribute notice to people. There's nothing in the record to suggest that either the trustee or the plan disseminated that notice to the participants. We did not get any objections from a participant in the plan. The plan has never submitted that these people, who it claims are the beneficial owners of the common stock, not something else, which we contend, ever received a copy of the notice.
The plan or the trustee got the notice, though, right?
Yes, they did. So, and they didn't distribute it to the people who they now claim are the class members, and that's the reason why we're here. So it's hard for me to reconcile the fact, A, that it's not the plan who filed the claim, that the claim is really being filed on behalf of the beneficial owners, but the people who are advancing that argument never seem to have disseminated the notice to those people.
Is there anything that prohibits the plan or its participants from filing a fresh securities fraud action, other than maybe the statute of limitations?
Other than the statute of limitations, I mean, and of course they could file a case that's time barred and it would probably be dismissed, but I don't know of any. Because the exclusionary language, they make a significant point about, you know, what the ERISA claims were excluded from the settlement, and that's an indication that they are in the class. I would respectfully contest that point for the following reason. The exclusionary language, if you look at the definition of settled claims in the stipulation of settlement, and it is also in the judgment that the district court entered, that claim, or that definition says, for Motorola securities that are not in this class. So to the extent that claims are released, claims are not released on behalf of Motorola securities that are not in the class. The Motorola stock fund is not a security that is in the class. Those claims were not released. So on all of these points, I think what you see here is the plan is attempting to make a series of arguments where it wants to constitute itself as having the quality of the plan in terms of what securities were purchased.
But who's looking out for the interests of these employees? I mean, I don't – on the one hand, it struck me that the district judge said in this case, well, they're protected by virtue of the fact that they have this pending ERISA action, and then 3 months later said in the ERISA action, oh, by the way, they should have pursued a securities fraud claim. And it's, you know, it's like a three-card Monty here. You know, it's they're being shuffled back and forth. Can you help me out with that?
I appreciate your point, Your Honor. I think the fact is that, you know, we as class counsel were retained by a purchaser who bought Motorola common stock and Motorola debt securities. We did not ever contend that we represented every Motorola security out there. Motorola is a very significant company, has numerous classes of debt. It has options that are issued. There were five classes of debt included in our class. There were many other classes of debt that were not. The class did not include options. We did not view it was our charge to basically take a plenary view as to every security that Motorola issued and bring claims. There were issues with certain claims. There would be, I believe, to answer Your Honor's point, difficulties in bringing a claim on behalf of the Motorola Common Stock Fund. There are issues of reliance in securities class actions, and there's a presumption of reliance that attaches to securities that trade in an efficient market. I think there would be significant defenses to bringing a claim on behalf of a security such as this. I would like to address counsel's reliance on the Kurzweil case, which I think is distinguishable, and I think that the district court noted that. And Kurzweil, what you have is a situation where the class was not defined as narrowly or I think as precisely as the class in this case. And that decision is, of course, not controlling. The plan also relies on the Great Neck case, which I think is extremely distinguishable and actually I think could be viewed as helpful to our position, which in Great Neck, a participant, not the plan, a participant objected to a securities class action prior to when the judgment was entered. It objected to the class definition and then engaged in a discourse with counsel and the parties. to alter the exclusions and to alter the terms of that settlement. It's clearly a different situation than what has happened here, where the plan has come after judgment was entered and is suggesting that the judgment should basically be reinterpreted so that the participants who we don't view our class members should be allowed to have a claim. I would also submit to you that the proof of claim that was filed was signed by a Motorola executive, and the proof of claim itself contains releases, and it requires that the release be signed in order for a claim to be made. When you go and you look through the plan documents and the trust agreement that were submitted into the record in the district court, there is, in my view at least, no point in those agreements that would suggest that the participants, who they claim are the real actors in this case, the people who seek to recover, have assigned their right to participate in settlements or to bring claims to the plan. So there's a question, there really is a question as to whether or not the plan can do that, can file this claim on behalf of the participants. So if you look at those documents and you look at the way the plan's claim was submitted, I think the only conclusion that can be drawn is that it is, in fact, the plan that is pursuing this remedy. In addition to that point, I would also point out that the data that was submitted on behalf of the plan for this class period runs from February 3rd, 2000 to May 14th, 2001. And during that time period, there was a significant amount of volume in Motorola common stock that was traded on several exchanges. The data that the plan submitted for the first 5 months of the class period only exists at the aggregate level. It's not clear to us that they have the ability to retain or to pull out the data reflecting individual participants' purchases. So if they were to be successful, it doesn't seem to us that there's any clear way that they could allocate what they recover across that population of people who are the participants who they are seeking recovery on behalf of. In addition to that fact, because the individual data doesn't exist for the first 5 months, we presume that the plan includes Motorola executives, and the class specifically excluded officers of the company. So to the extent that the plan's data, which they are seeking recovery for, includes other individuals who are excluded from the class, they have no way of disaggregating that data. On the point of control, which I think is fairly well settled, the plan clearly is controlled by the plan committee. Those people who are on the plan committee serve at the pleasure of Motorola's board of directors and can be removed at any time without cause. In addition, I would say that the plan raises several arguments on the issue of whether or not the fund is an actual, or the fund participants are actual beneficial owners. And I would submit to you, Your Honor, that these units of the common stock fund are not common stock. They are something quite different. They do not bear the CUSIP number that the common stock bears. The participants could not take these unitized interests onto the New York Stock Exchange or any other exchange and sell them. They're something that's different. They're issued in fractional amounts. I can't go to the New York Stock Exchange and buy 0.78 shares of Motorola. I could buy one share, I could buy 100 shares, but I can't buy 0.78 shares. So the idea that because there's some fund that has an interest that would allow economically on some level the participants to own an interest in something that's like Motorola common stock does not satisfy the definition of the class that requires it to be publicly traded Motorola common stock with a specific CUSIP number. In addition, several things that the fund has submitted in the record indicate that what the participants own are fund units, not common stock. If you look at, there's an affidavit that they submitted in the district court by a woman named Sheila Forsberg, and she has a significant administrative role at the plan. She submits that what the people own are units in the fund, not common stock. So even by the plan's own description of what the securities are, it's quite clear that what they own is something other than Motorola common stock. On the point of the SEC no action letters, which the defendants, or I'm sorry, the plan relies on quite extensively, I would submit to you that they're distinguishable in a very significant way. In the SEC no action letters that they submit, what the SEC is allowing under Rule 144A is the activity that's specifically directed by participants, by individual non-affiliate employees. And that's quite different here, where we have a plan that is an affiliate of the company that has submitted a claim and that has now sought recovery. Your Honor, I see that my time is almost up, so I thank you.
I'd like to begin by correcting one thing I said, I believe, in response to a question from Judge Sykes. I responded affirmatively to the question as to whether or not the plan held title to the securities. It's actually the trustee who holds title to the securities. So that was an inaccuracy on my part.
Is that a material difference for purposes of the argument?
I think it is a material difference in the sense that there's an independent body that holds title to the securities, yes, and it shows that the trustee is trustee on behalf of the participants. There's no argument here seeking to overturn the settlement. The reason for that is very simple. The participants are entitled to participate in the settlement. So we're not seeking to overturn the settlement. You know, the argument that Mr. Herod made that this would materially alter the settlement, we have responded to by showing that the assertions made in the brief to support that are unsupported in the record, firstly, and even if accepted, do not establish that granting this claim on behalf of the participants would indeed in any way significantly alter the settlement.
Why wouldn't it, though, if there's 77,000 additional class members?
That's because the amount of shares purchased for the participants' accounts, which was roughly 25 million, is de minimis, a very small percentage of the total assumed shares that lead plaintiff accounts entered in somehow or other. We don't have no explanation, no record support, entered in somehow or other into the settlement agreement in the first place.
What's so, the value of your claim?
The value of the claim would have to be determined according to the plan of allocation, and frankly, Your Honor, no one has done that precisely yet. It's several million dollars from our view. A certain amount of money was set aside in connection with the proceedings in the district court, which I believe was calculated to be $6 million, and lead plaintiff made that calculation, although said that they had, in essence, over-reserved for the amount of the claim. So in terms of the total $190 million settlement, the claim is relatively small, though significant to the participants who seek to share in it. The question was put by Judge Simon as to why exclude these people from the settlement. And frankly, there's no answer to that. There's no reason why these people should not be eligible to share in the settlement. Mr. Herod conceded nobody paid attention to it in the district court. I think that's very significant. So that the assertion about what the intention was that's made in the brief is just shown to be, in fact, unsupported.
Well, this is a legal question, not an equitable question, right?
I agree it's a legal question.
You might have all kinds of equities on your side, but we're bound by the class definition and the terms of the settlement agreement.
The court is bound by the terms of the settlement agreement. That is correct. But
and the class definition.
And the class definition.
So this is a question of legal interpretation.
This is a question of legal interpretation. That's been our position all along. However, I submit the court, first of all, should not ignore the consequences. And more materially, I would submit that the court should not ignore the fact that the participants here are just like everybody else who bought Motorola common stock in terms of the information they relied on presumptively and the losses that they suffered. I want to say one thing about the data issues that Mr. Herod raised. We've fully responded to those in our brief, but there are two points I must respond to. Number one is, regardless of what might what one might conclude about the first 4.5 months of the class period when data is lacking on an individual participant level. It's in the record. We've shown it. It exists for 10.5 months out of this time period. There's no reason if somehow or other the district court on remand were to decide there was no right to recover for the first 4.5 months, participants should be denied the right to recover for the last 10.5 months. Secondly, as for the suggestion that Motorola executives who were somehow or other defendants or otherwise key executives in this case would be entitled to share, we've taken the position in connection with the submission of the claim and the district court that those individuals would be excluded from any recovery under the settlement. For all the reasons I've just stated, I would request that the case be remanded to the district court with instructions to grant Motorola's claim. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.